Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have Germany's recent decision to freeze arms exports to Turkey, as well as to the countries involved in the war on Yemen. This latest step was taken in response to Operation Olive Branch, while the earlier one was due to the rising grassroots pressure on Berlin to distance itself from the Saudis' disastrous military campaign. The Central European country has long been leveraging its arms export industry in order to expand its influence in the Mideast, but it's nowadays coming at the cost of the country's soft power due to the Western public's disapproval of the Saudi and Turkish operations. Germany is making an effort to show that it's responding to this criticism, though it's unclear as of now whether it's only paying superficial lip service to its citizens or if it truly intends to reevaluate its military relationship with these two Muslim great powers. The reason for such suspicion is because the Yemeni announcement is very vague and leaves open the possibility that exports to so-called transfer countries such as the UK and France will still occur, thus maintaining a workaround to enable Germany to indirectly sell its wares to Saudi Arabia and others. Furthermore, there's no confirmation yet as to whether this will affect existing contracts that are currently being implemented or will only pertain to future ones. As for Turkey, the decision is a lot more clear-cut, because Berlin announced that it's suspending talks for upgrading the country's German-made tanks, thus dealing yet another blow to the already fractured German-Turkish relationship. Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel also indicated that the sale of weapons to conflict regions is becoming a highly sensitive issue in the drawn-out coalition talks that have been going on for months already, apparently trying to attribute some blame for the impasse on Berlin's arms exports to the Mideast. This is probably a politically convenient deflection from Merkel's unwillingness to moderate her euro-liberal agenda in order to form a new government, but it nonetheless suggests that the issue is becoming contentious enough to warrant a public response of some sort. Even so, it's unlikely that Germany will cede its position as one of the world's largest arms exporters just to satisfy the same euro-liberal base that it ironically helped cultivate. For as liberal as Germany is on the domestic and continental front, its leadership embraces ruthless realism when it comes to non-European affairs in Africa and the Mideast, and its military diplomacy is part and parcel of the EU leaders' interactions with its civilizationally dissimilar geopolitical periphery. In the case of Africa, Berlin is promoting multilateral military deployments in Niger and elsewhere in order to stem illegal migration, while its engagement with the Mideast sees it sell arms to great powers in order to strengthen state-to-state partnerships, to say nothing of Germany's open support of regime change in Syria. Altogether, the lesson is that even hyper-liberal countries shrewdly utilize a set of neo-realist policy options on the international stage, no matter how much this may contradict their stated values. The next one up is the significance of Netanyahu's meeting with President Putin earlier this week. The Israeli premier traveled to Moscow to meet with the Russian leader and discuss issues of pressing international importance, with reports stating that Syria and Iran were high on the agenda. As could have been expected, no concrete details of their talks leaked to the public, but what was already released is significant enough. Russia and Israel are very close partners, and this extends to Moscow entering into a so-called deconfliction agreement with Tel Aviv so as to avoid any unnecessary clashes above Syrian airspace. Israel has also been insistent about setting up a de facto safe zone or buffer zone along the occupied Golan Heights using Syrian-based proxies under the pretext of preventing Hezbollah and the IRGC from approaching its borders. And it's likely that the practical formalization of this project was discussed with President Putin in the context of the Syrian National Dialogue Congress that began in Sochi that day. This brings the analysis along to discussing that symbolic backdrop and a strong sign of the privileged value that Russia attaches to its ties with Israel. President Putin chose to meet with Netanyahu instead of attending the opening of the event that he himself originally conceived of last fall, It also speaks to the Israeli Prime Minister's perception of this conference's importance, that he felt the need to urgently meet with President Putin on the day that it began, and what could only be speculated was a bid to influence its outcome. Of course, Russia has always maintained that it's simply providing a neutral forum for Syrians to jumpstart the implementation of UNSC Resolution 2254's stipulated constitutional reform and the organization of new elections. So, officially speaking, Moscow does not want to interfere in this strictly internal process. Having said that, Israel may have thought the opposite and believed that it could lobby Russia to support some of its desired interests. As was explained, Israel wants to contain Iran in Syria, and this could best be achieved through the strengthening of its so-called buffer zone near the Golan Heights, brought about by this territory's semi-formalization as a separate political unit in a future decentralized Syria. Relatedly, the centrifugal forces that have torn Syrian society apart over the past 7 years might make this solution inevitable in the sense that the country's geographic military divisions could crystallize if decentralization is included in its new constitution, which could inadvertently lead to the establishment of unofficial spheres of influence as external parties rely on their Syrian proxies to promote their interest in these prospectively formed administrative areas. That's not to suggest that decentralization in and of itself is an Israeli or any other foreign plot, or that Russia is promoting this possibility in order to please Netanyahu or anyone else, but just that it's nevertheless in Tel Aviv's interest to see this happen. The timing of Netanyahu's sudden trip to Moscow indicates that it was largely motivated by him wanting to tell President Putin Israel's preferred vision for a post-war Syria that he thinks could most effectively mitigate Iran's influence in their country. But whether or not he ultimately succeeds in getting what he wants, or is even capable of influencing events through his partnership with Russia, is altogether another matter entirely. Third Internal Countdown is the separatist rebellion in South Yemen. Clashes broke out in the country's interim capital of Aden, which was also the seat of government for the formerly independent country of South Yemen, over the weekend after President Hadi banned the Southern Transitional Council and its supporters from protesting it. The STC had given the Yemeni leader an ultimatum set to expire on Sunday to replace his allegedly corrupt government or face a revolt. And they claim that he ordered his soldiers to shoot at activists who defied his anti-protest decree and tried to assemble in the city regardless. The fast-moving situation saw the party's armed wing, the Southern Resistance Forces, take over Aden in a move that Hadi's government decried as a coup, which will undoubtedly have profound domestic and international implications. The country's internationally recognized government was already expelled from the former territory of North Yemen following the success of the Houthi insurgency in early 2015 and the militant subsequent alliance with former President Saleh's General People's Congress. And the authority's eviction from South Yemen essentially means that it no longer has any formal representation in the nominally unified state, thereby setting the stage for its redivision into its two previously independent constituent halves. This unfolding scenario could pit coalition allies Saudi Arabia and the UAE against one another, since Riyadh is said to be in favor of preserving the country's unity, while Abu Dhabi is allegedly backing the STC and wants to restore South Yemeni independence. A further wrinkle in all of this is that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is supposedly mentored by his older Abu Dhabi counterpart Mohammed bin Zayed, so any split between the two would be deeply personal. That said, the two Gulf allies will probably resolve whatever disagreements they may have about Yemen's post-war political future behind closed doors, and the UAE will be wise to present a face-saving method for MBS to change his presumed position and accept South Yemen's secession if the STC is successful with its struggle. Riyadh might have ultimately backed the wrong horse by supporting the unpopular Hadi, who was visibly despised in both parts of the country. So this inconvenient fact alone might be enough to get it to reconsider its backing for this failed politician and come to grips with the reality that neither Northerners nor Southerners want him ruling over their country. Getting rid of him, however, will nullify the official reason for the Saudi-led war on Yemen in the first place, but that in and of itself might be the pretext that Riyadh needs to downscale its disastrous and highly expensive participation in this conflict. All told, the seemingly unexpected rebellion of Yemen's southern secessionists might represent the final phase of the war on Yemen, if the STC is able to oust Hadi's government from Aden once and for all. And a prospectively Russian-brokered solution might see the country either decentralized along the Bosnian model of broadly independent identity federal halves, or outright return to its pre-1990 division into two de jure independent states. Our runner-up is the riots that have broken out in India over the release of a controversial film. The Bollywood spectacle, Padmavat, was scandalously reported to feature a love scene between the fabled Hindu queen Padmavati and a Muslim conqueror, something that the directors always denied, but which nonetheless incensed Hindu hardliners over the past couple of months. As the movie approached its officially release date, riotous mobs wreaked havoc in parts of the country, in an effort to intimidate cinemas from showing the film and scare people away from seeing it. Some women threatened to commit collective suicide if it wasn't banned, and so-called protesters even attacked a school bus full of children in one shocking incident. A member of the ruling BJP also announced a bounty for anyone who would behead the main actress, though he was later detained. Hindutva followers claim that Padmavat is disrespectful to the woman that some of them worship as an actual deity, with or without the inclusion of the fake news love scene. While critics say that India is supposed to be the world's largest democracy, and that filmmakers should therefore be able to make whatever movies they want. Moreover, they deny that there's anything controversial about how Padmavati is portrayed. The uproar that this movie is already responsible for has raised concerns about India's growing religious extremism among its Hindu majority population, and the violent enforcement of ultra-fundamentalist precepts in the constitutionally secular state. It also comes in the heels of large-scale caste violence in the Western economic capital of Mumbai that instantly triggered questions about the veracity of India's claims over the years that its social situation was improving. Most disturbing, however, is that the driving force behind the movie-related unrest is the debunked claim that it features a Hindu woman copulating with a Muslim man, as interconfessional relationships are increasingly becoming taboo in today's India due to the Hindutva paranoia that they constitute something referred to as love jihad, or the conspiracy theory that Muslim men are tricking Hindu women to convert to Islam out of love. With this backdrop in mind, the pandemonium surrounding Padmavat can be understood as a veiled manifestation of anti-Muslim rage. Though that's not to say that some PS Hindus aren't protesting the film for legitimate reasons, unrelated to Islam, and focused on what they believe to be an overall unfair portrayal of their goddess. In terms of the bigger picture, the controversy that this movie created is proof that India is in the throes of a massive culture war between religious fundamentalists and constitutional secularists, one which has larger overtones of a so-called clash of civilizations between Hinduism and Islam, and represents a Damocles sword hanging over the heads of the more than 1 billion people inhabiting the subcontinent. At our top spot, we've got Poland passing an internationally contentious draft law banning the phrase Polish death camps, the Bandera ideology, and the denial of wartime Ukrainian fascist crimes. Israel and Ukraine reacted with fury at the decision and harshly criticized Poland for what they each claim for their own respective reasons was historical revisionism. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu forcefully condemned the bill and hinted that it amounts to denying the Holocaust, and a few people frenziedly speculated that it would outlaw any conversation about the complicity of some Polish citizens in that tragic event. Kiev, meanwhile, decried what it claimed was the painting of all Ukrainians as fascist sympathizers and protested Warsaw's use of pre-war geographic terminology in reference to the genocide of Poles by Ukrainian so-called nationalists in Volhynia and Eastern Galicia. newly appointed Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki responded to his Israeli counterpart over the weekend when he wrote on Twitter that Jews, Poles, and all victims should be guardians of the memory of all who were murdered by German Nazis. Auschwitz-Birkenau is not a Polish name, and Arbeit macht frei is not a Polish phrase. One day before the two spoke to each other and agreed to enter into a dialogue on this issue. To be fair, historian Jan Grabowski has argued in his work that some Poles did in fact do terrible things to Jews, but claiming that these individuals committed these acts on behalf of the Polish nation and collectively punishing the entire population with undeserved guilt is wrong and could be criminalized under the new legislation. After all, approximately 6 million Poles were killed during the Nazi occupation, representing around one-fifth of its total pre-war citizenry, which objectively makes the Polish nation a victim of World War II, not an aggressor like the German one was. Relatedly, Poles also suffered at the hands of the Hitler-aligned Bandera fascists, who slaughtered around 100,000 civilians in the former eastern borderland of the Polish Second Republic, and committed acts of terrorism against its people before the war. But Warsaw made the political decision to accept more than 1.5 million Ukrainian migrants over the past 4 years, despite these individuals being predisposed to favoring the fascist Bandera ideology and its territorial claims against modern-day Poland. The Polish public is disgusted at the open embrace of fascism by Ukraine's post-coup political elite, and the glorification of Bandera in particular, and the state seems to have finally realized the long-term security implications of short-sightedly allowing so many Ukrainians into the country, some of whom might be Bandera sleeper cell sympathizers, hence why they want to belatedly outlaw his ideology. Taken together, the country's supposedly controversial draft legislation is designed to protect the Polish nation from defamation through the weaponized inference that so-called Polish death camps whitewash Nazi atrocities and revise history in order to solely blame Poles, the same as the government wants to protect the security of the Polish people by finally making it illegal for any of the over 1.5 million Ukrainian migrants in the country to support Bandera's fascist ideology and territorial claims. Israel and Ukraine are trying to discredit Poland's Euro-realist government, but they're actually inadvertently raising the appeal of the ruling Law and Justice Party among the many Poles inside the country who know better and see this as the unwarranted attacks against historical truth and national dignity that they truly are. All right, folks, this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. I'm going to be on holidays for the upcoming 2 weeks, so I won't be broadcasting again until the middle of February. So hope you guys will listen then, and hope everyone has a wonderful upcoming 2 weeks. Thanks. Bye.